Hey, Mike here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Dark Poutine early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Welcome back to Dark Poutine. I am Mike Brown.
And I am Matthew Stockton, in bed in Vancouver because my husband is on a conference call and Steve is on the bed with me and he's doing one of those like dig before he lays down. So if you hear the digging sound, it's the dog.
Oh God.
Trying to fluff the duvet.
I might stop us when we hear the digging just so everybody else doesn't have to listen to it because we can do that. This is, it's called editing. It's amazing.
What? We're not live?
No. Oh gosh, no. If we were live, you would hear me stutter and fall over words and all kinds of terrible things.
I was going to say, we should do a live show. Then I realized, can you even do a live show with podcasts?
Absolutely you can.
Okay.
Yeah, we could do a live show. We could stream live. Morgan and I are streaming live tonight.
Oh, fun.
The views, information, and opinions expressed during the Dark Poutine podcast are solely those of the producer and do not necessarily represent those of Curious Cast, its affiliate, Global News, nor their parent company, Chorus Entertainment.
Dark Poutine is not for the faint of heart or squeamish. Listener discretion is strongly advised. We're not experts on the topics we present, nor are we journalists. We're two ordinary Canadians chatting about crime and the dark side of history. Let's get to it. Put on your toque, grab yourself a double-double and a Nanaimo bar. It's time to scarf down some Dark Poutine.
You are responsible for obtaining and maintaining at your own cost all equipment needed to listen to Dark Poutine. Dark Poutine can be addictive. Side effects may include, but not be limited to, pausing and questioning the system, elevated heart rate, pondering humanity, odd looks from colleagues as you laugh out loud at work, family members not into true crime worrying about you. Positive side effects may include some perspectives and opinions that you disagree with, as well as some wokeness and empathy. If you don't think Dark Poutine is for you, consult your doctor immediately.
Douglas Donald Moore, known in Meadowvale, Ontario as a drug supplier for young teens, gained notoriety in Mississauga for killing three young men before taking his own life in his jail cell while awaiting trial on 11 charges for sexual assaults on three young boys. Peel Regional Police assert that Robert Greval, 22, of Meadowvale, and Giuseppe Joseph Mancisi, 20, of Milton, who were close friends, were killed in 2003 by Moore. After Moore's death, he was named the prime suspect in the murders of Greval and Mancisi. Additionally, police believe Moore was responsible for killing René Charlebois, 15, also of Meadowvale. All three victims disappeared in late 2003 and their bodies were discovered in spring of 2004. Charlebois' remains were found in an Orangeville landfill, while Greval and Mancisi's partial remains were located in wooded areas near Montreal. In 2005, Moore's former common-law wife and an unidentified 16-year-old were convicted of accessory to murder after the fact. The teen assisted in disposing of evidence, including driving with Moore to Quebec to bury the bodies of Greval and Mancisi. Moore believed the two men had stolen drugs and cash from him, but it was later revealed that the unnamed 16-year-old was the one responsible for the robbery. The police have never disclosed the motive behind the killing of René Charlebois. This is Dark Poutine Episode 313, Murders in Meadowvale, Robert Greval, Joseph Mancisi, and René Charlebois. Mississauga, Ontario has evolved from a collection of small villages and hamlets into Canada's sixth largest city, known for its diverse population and economic significance. Initially, the area was inhabited by indigenous peoples, including the Huron-Wendat, Haudenosaunee, and Anishinaabeg, with the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation playing a pivotal role in the region's early European settlement history. The city's name, Mississauga, is believed to be derived from the Anishinaabe word Missisagging, which means those at the Great River Mouth, reflecting its rich indigenous heritage. The modern city of Mississauga was formed in 1974 through the amalgamation of the town of Mississauga and the towns of Port Credit and Streetsville, laying the foundation for a rapidly growing municipality. This amalgamation united diverse communities, fostering a vibrant, multicultural urban center. Situated directly west of Toronto within the regional municipality of Peel, Mississauga is a crucial part of the Greater Toronto Area, GTA. Its growth and development as a bustling suburban city have been significantly fueled by its proximity to Toronto, particularly with the Toronto Pearson International Airport in its northeastern area acting as a central transportation hub. The city's eastern boundary along Etobicoke Creek further cements its connection with Toronto, contributing to its thriving economy and diverse cultural landscape. The strategic geographical positioning underscores Mississauga's importance within the GTA and highlights its transformation into an urban center with a vibrant economy and rich cultural diversity. And Matthew, what do you think of Mississauga?
So... picture it, 1990. I'm a downtown Toronto snob, and I had a job in Mississauga, and I had to drive out there every day, and I called it Mississauga. And that I'm not dissing the place at all. There are some beautiful areas of Mississauga, but just schlepping out there every day on the QEW sucked balls.
Yeah, I bet you it did. I like how Ontarians name their different places interesting things, like. My buddy Paul calls Oshawa the dirty schwa.
The dirty schwa.
I don't know why that is, but anyway. Amid this backdrop of development and prosperity, Mississauga, a city known for its peaceful suburbs, has had its share of dark moments with notable murder cases that captured national attention. A few of these cases are notorious for their complexity and the tragic narratives they unraveled. One of the most notorious cases occurred in the 1970s involving the murder of 33-year-old fashion model Christine Demeter, a case we covered in episode 56 of this podcast. Found dead in the garage of her Mississauga home on July 18, 1973, Christine suffered from severe head wounds inflicted by a blunt object believed to have been a tire iron or a crowbar. The case took a sensational turn as investigations revealed her husband, Peter Demeter, had orchestrated the murder, motivated by the desire to claim a significant insurance payout and due to his involvement with another woman. Despite the actual murderer for hire, a small-time criminal dying in Hungary 2 years later, Peter Demeter was convicted of non-capital murder, revealing a tale of greed, betrayal, and the ultimate violence within a marital relationship. In 1983, 18-year-old Barbara Turnbull, a student at Clarkson Secondary School, faced a horrifying and unprovoked attack. During an armed robbery at Becker's convenience store, she was shot in the neck, leaving her paralyzed with quadriplegia. The assailants, Hugh Logan, Sutcliffe Logan, Warren Johnson, and Clive Brown, committed this senseless act of violence. Despite her disability, Turnbull became an advocate for disabled rights and a prominent journalist for the Toronto Star. She passed away in 2015 due to pneumonia complications at the age of 50. Another heart-wrenching series of events, a case we have yet to cover, known as the Harrison family murders, spanned years and culminated in the deaths of three family members, Bridget and Bill Harrison and their son, Caleb. Bridget and Bill, unable to have children naturally, adopted Caleb, who met his future wife, Melissa Merritt, in 2000. The marriage, however, turned sour, leading to accusations, a custody battle over their children, and eventually the tragic deaths of Caleb and his parents in their family home under suspicious circumstances over the span of several years. Melissa Merritt and her new partner, Christopher Fattor, were implicated in the murders, revealing a convoluted plot of familial discord, manipulation, and murder. Meadowvale, where this story is focused, is a neighborhood in the northwestern part of Mississauga. It was developed as a master planned community in the early 1970s, part of the wave of suburban development around Toronto during the latter half of the 20th century. Before it developed into a residential suburb, the area was primarily rural, with agriculture being the main economic activity. The design of Meadowvale aimed to balance residential, commercial, and recreational spaces, integrating parks, schools, and shopping areas within walking distance of homes. It was one of the first communities in Canada to employ the concept of cul-de-sacs and winding roads that are common in suburban developments today. These design choices were intended to reduce traffic flow and create quieter, more family-friendly residential areas. As for its history of violent crime, Meadowvale, like any community, has experienced its share of incidents over the years. However, it's important to note that compared to urban centers, suburban areas like Meadowvale generally have lower crime rates. According to Area Vibes, Meadowvale presents a picture of relative safety compared to national averages, with crime rates significantly lower across various categories. The statistics for the broader Meadowvale area are reassuring. Total crime rates are reported to be 50% lower than the national average, with violent crimes 48% lower. The chance of becoming a victim of crime in Meadowvale is about 1 in 48, indicating that it is safer than 68% of the cities in Ontario. Year over year, Mississauga has seen a 16% decrease in crime, indicating a positive trend towards safety and security. Donald Douglas Moore's actions introduce a troubling aspect to Meadowvale's otherwise serene and culturally vibrant history. Moore's actions are a stark reminder that the most depraved and violent crime can infiltrate even the most tight-knit communities, underscoring the ongoing need for alertness to protect the peace everyone cherishes. At 22, Robert Greval led a life of quiet promise and understated ambition. He had completed his secondary education at Meadowvale Secondary School. He continued living with his family with aspirations for bigger and better things. Robert embarked on a journey to further his education in business at Humber College. This pursuit was not just academic, but a stepping stone toward realizing his entrepreneurial dreams. According to his mother, he envisioned himself at the helm of his own business, contemplating ventures as varied as a grocery store or a video store. His desire to carve out a niche in the competitive business world fueled his dream. While studying, Robert also worked at Sobeys in Milton, treating it as an opportunity to apply his business education practically by understanding the ins and outs of retail management. The experience underscored his dedication to marrying academic learning with real-world application, solidifying his entrepreneurial goals.
You know, I'm thinking about this young man and all of his potential and his family. And as you know, my husband has Indian heritage.
Right.
So my feelings for his parents are maybe a little bit heightened because...
You understand the culture a little more.
I understand it. And I know the love and the hope that many Indian parents put into their sons.
Yes.
And Greval is a historic family name from a big clan of the Jat people who... were in northern India and then eventually settled in the Punjab. And his parents are Sikh, so most of the Sikh Grevals were from eastern Punjab. So I'm sitting here thinking that just all these generations of families, of his family moving around India, and then all the hopes and struggles they had, and eventually, you know, either his parents or grandparents or great-grandparents moved to Canada, they settle in Meadowvale, and then this monster takes the poor kid's life, this short, sharp end to...
All these hopes and dreams.
All these hopes and dreams of generations, you know? It's just horrible.
Robert Greville's best friend was Giuseppe Mancisi, a 20-year-old better known as Joe or Joseph to those around him. Like Robert, Joe Mancisi stood on the brink of a promising future. His good looks and amiable personality made him a well-liked figure, not just among his peers, but also within the broader community of Milton, a town nestled west of Mississauga. The Mancisi family, over the course of 34 years, had woven themselves into the fabric of the town through their ventures in real estate, automotive tires, and, in particular, the culinary scene, with their involvement in restaurants. Joe inherited not only his father Joseph Sr.'s name, but also his sharp intellect and business acumen.
You know, and again, despite you know, we'll talk about this a little bit, some low-level crime that he and his friend were doing. Mm-hmm. You know, this kid sounds like, well, he's a young man, but I'm in my 50s, so I'm going to call him a kid, right?
Sure,
This kid probably would have made something out of himself. And
totally.
By his name, I'm guessing he's Italian. That's a pretty Italian name.
One of the restaurants they run is called an Italian eatery, so
okay. Yes. Okay, yeah. You haven't spent a lot of time in Toronto, Mike, but the GTA has a massive Italian population. Mm-hmm. Did you know, this is a fun fact, after Bologna in Italy, Toronto is technically the next largest Italian city in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, they have a big tribe, and you know, what would Canada be without Italian restaurants? Such good food.
We would be a lesser country, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I bet this kid would have become, he probably would have become an entrepreneur of some kind, judging, you know, from
family. He already kind of was.
Yeah, and but he would have probably, like, really, you know, he's only in his 20s, struck out and really, really done something with himself. It's so sad, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Beyond his business smarts, young Joe was known for his culinary skills, academic excellence, and unwavering loyalty to his friends. He actively participated in the family business, working closely with his father, and shared memorable experiences through travels to Italy and Mexico, exploring new cultures and bonding over these adventures. Despite the family navigating the complexities of divorce, Joe remained a supportive and caring son to his mother, with whom he lived in Milton. His adolescence was marked by a minor misstep at 15 involving a physical altercation that resulted in community service order. Yet, this did little to tarnish his character. By 2003, Joe was advancing his ambitions by pursuing a business degree at George Brown College in Toronto, intending to deepen his involvement in the family's diverse business interests, proving his dedication to continuing the Mancisi legacy. Police would later reveal that both young men were involved in low-level drug dealing in the area and, as a result, knew some unsavory characters, one of whom, Douglas Moore, would eventually kill them both. Nothing was out of the ordinary on the morning of November 12, 2003, when Joseph Mancisi and Robert Greville were last seen alive by Robert's mom, Jatinder, at around 10:30 a.m. as they left in Joe's blue Honda. The pair told Jatinder that they were going to the Tim Hortons on Derry Road and 10th Line to grab a coffee, and they'd be right back. Robert told his sister that he and Joe had a meeting with someone at the Tim's, but she didn't know who it was that he was meeting or why. Jatinder Greville expressed growing concern when her son failed to return home that evening. She called Joe's cell phone but received no answer. By the following day, she was really worried, but her son was a man after all. He could do as he liked, but no word from him was out of character. After talking with Joe's family 2 days later, Robert's family called to report him as a missing person. Joe's family did the same. The officers who came by the Greville home later suggested to Jatinder that her son might have taken an impromptu trip to Mexico with his buddy or simply needed some time alone, especially since he had been missing for several days. She thought the trip idea was ridiculous, especially as Robert had just gone out for coffee and taken nothing with him. Not to mention both young men had steady girlfriends, and they'd not heard from them either.
You know, why would they suggest Mexico?
The motivation for that hasn't been made publicly.
And why the lack of urgency? You know, I hate...
They're grown men, Matthew.
Yeah, but I hate to say this. Mm-hmm. I hate to say it, but I've seen it time and time again, especially in Greater Toronto Area Police, mm-hmm. If this is a white kid, would they have acted differently?
Joe Mancisi's a white kid.
Yeah. I guess you're right. I just, you know, the Toronto and area police with my community have not been the best. So I'm always very wary of what they're doing.
I get into it here very briefly about why people think maybe the police weren't as urgent at first.
Okay.
If Robert had wanted to be alone, he would have let his family know where he was. He always let Jatinder know where he was going and when he could be expected back. Her maternal intuition told her that something was wrong, very wrong. Both families sensed that lack of urgency from the police in the search for the two young men. Robert's past, marred by a minor drug-related record, seemed to bias the police against him, his family believed. Feeling overlooked and desperate for answers, the families resolved to bypass the authorities and embarked on their own mission to uncover the whereabouts of their missing sons. They pooled their resources, determined to do everything they could to bring their loved ones home. Joe Mancisi Sr., fueled by parental concern, swiftly transitioned from reporting his son's disappearance to action. Mr. Mancisi mobilized a network of relatives and staff to aid in the search for Joe. Clues emerged from the young man's bedroom, address books, cryptic notes, and fragments of a life yet to be fully understood. The urgency was palpable as they dialed numbers, seeking answers. Among the leads they ran down was one that led to Douglas Donald Moore, a Meadowvale resident with a checkered past. Mr. Mancisi spoke with Moore on the phone but was rebuffed. Moore denied knowing Joe, but something he'd said had struck Mr. Mancisi as odd. According to the Toronto Star newspaper, before he promptly hung up on Joe Mancisi Sr., Doug Moore spat out, quote, "Do you know how old I am? What would I have to do with this guy who is 20 years old?" Click, phone hangs up. Mancisi had not told Moore his son's age, and if he didn't know him, how did he know that? Joe Mancisi Sr. dug deeper, and friends hesitantly shared more information. Doug Moore, they said, believed Joe and Robert had robbed him in the weeks leading up to their disappearance, and he vowed retribution. The Greville family was told the same thing. Doug Moore was the guy to look at more closely. The police were alerted and reassurances were offered. A seasoned Halton police detective dismissed Moore as a non-threatening figure. Moore, he said, was a pedophile and was no one to be worried about. The detective followed that sentiment, noting, quote, "These guys are not usually dangerous," end quote.
These guys are not usually dangerous.
Yeah, what is that?
Tell that to the kids that they rape.
Right. The guy who did that to me, I think, is a pretty dangerous person. What kind of injury does it require for you to be dangerous? You know, if you traumatize somebody, you're not dangerous?
Pedophiles piss me off.
Me too. According to the Toronto Star, as the families tirelessly called around that fateful Saturday, a tree cutter in a quiet Montreal suburb stumbled upon a gruesome discovery. The torso of a young man concealed among the bushes. The location lay across the river from Notre Dame de Grasse. The hands and head had been methodically removed. An identifying tattoo, later determined to be the name of a family member, once etched onto the corpse's shoulder, had been sliced away. It would take the next 4 months before the body would be identified as that of Robert Greville, and the suburb's connection to Doug Moore would become clearer. Moore's father had lived there after divorcing Doug's mother. Not knowing of the discovery or its relevance to their search, in the meantime, the Greville and Mancisi families continued looking for their boys, hoping they'd come home. More after a quick break. And we're back, Matthew. Thoughts looking at this goofball's picture.
Okay,
he
totally looks like a pedo. I know, Mike, you can tell by looking at someone, but he does.
Yeah.
As I was reading this script today in advance, you always do this to me, Mike. My blood pressure was going up and up and up.
That's the way I write them.
Over how the judicial system, the authorities, and all the people that we put our trust in and pay for essentially
failed.
They let him slow walk through raping more and more kids and end up murdering three people.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And this guy, you don't touch on this in the script, but yeah, I did a bit of research. This guy, convicted pedo, was living behind a school.
Yes, he was. Yep. I mean, he positioned himself as pedophiles do.
More and more people in Canada are getting more and more
leeway when they're committing crimes. Is that where you're going?
No, I mean the rest of us are getting more and more peeved at another story and another story and another story of somebody who had, like, you know, 20 convictions for stuff and yet let out one more time.
Why do you think I'm telling these stories, Matthew? This is the entire reason that we tell these stories.
You're not doing it just to make me upset?
No, it's not just to make you upset. It's to make people think. I want people to be thinking about what is justice in Canada? What does that look like? And well, here it is.
It's just again and again and again. And you know me, like I'm all for, you know, people that can get out of a life of crime, right? Mm-hmm. And can be fixed if it were,
right?
But the people that we see being released and committing these horrible crimes, like any person with a sense of judgment or more like ability can see that they do it again, but yet the authorities let them out.
Right. They do.
Make me the master of all parole board.
Oh boy.
He looks like a pedo. Don't let him out.
Yeah, exactly. Douglas Donald Moore, the fifth child of Mildred and Douglas Sr., was born in Verdun, Quebec, a borough of Montreal located along the St. Lawrence River in 1967. Verdun was a bustling, densely populated suburb experiencing growth and change in the late 60s. This era was marked by a wave of construction and urban development reflecting the economic prosperity and optimism of the post-war years. Like much of Montreal, Verdun was impacted by the excitement surrounding Expo 67, the World's Fair held from April to October, which celebrated Canada's centennial. Expo 67, located on the islands in the St. Lawrence River, just a stone's throw from Verdun, brought a sense of pride and global attention to the city. The community of Verdun was characterized by its working-class roots, with a strong sense of neighborhood solidarity and a mix of residential, commercial, and industrial areas. Families, many of French-Canadian descent, lived in close-knit communities, often in walk-up apartment buildings or modest single-family homes. Verdun's parks and recreational areas, including its waterfront along the St. Lawrence River, were popular gathering places for residents. Being Anglophones in a primarily French neighborhood, the Moore family were always outsiders. When Douglas Sr., who'd grown up in New Brunswick, worked, which he did very intermittently, it was at low-paying odd jobs. He claimed his painful back kept him from doing more. The primary family income was a regular social assistance check. Even with five children to take care of, a large chunk of the family nut went every month to Douglas Sr.'s booze and prescription painkiller habit. Douglas Sr. raged, too, ruling their home with verbal threats and by a liberal amount of physical violence. The kids and Mildred were terrified of him. Also, as Doug Jr., affectionately known as Dougie, grew older, he encountered various health challenges. His early years were marked by a litany of medical issues, including allergies, asthma, and bronchitis, complicating his childhood further with a hereditary blood disorder passed down from one of his parents. To address severe ear infections that threatened his hearing, medical professionals inserted tubes into his ears, a measure that, while necessary, contributed to a degree of hearing loss. Doug wasn't the only one with health issues. His only brother faced his own set of hurdles, living with cerebral palsy and epilepsy, which presented significant developmental and physical challenges. Doug Jr. exhibited signs of a sharp intellect. He demonstrated considerable cognitive abilities, scoring highly on IQ tests in his later years. However, his intelligence didn't prevent him from acting out. At age 10, he orchestrated a small-scale heist with his friends, pilfering candy and chips from a local corner store. However, the group's attempt to transport their loot through the snow in a wagon left an unmistakable trail for the police to follow. Doug would later recount the story with a sense of humor, acknowledging the folly of their poorly executed plan and simplicity with which they were caught. Dougie Moore's acting out also came from a place of pain. He had a secret that only his siblings knew, but no one talked about. When Dougie was 7, his father started touching him. Douglas Sr. was touching some of the other kids too, but it wasn't until Dougie was 14 that the secret came out and his parents divorced. By that time, Dougie was already drinking and using drugs, mainly weed and hash. He started selling cannabis to his classmates the following year. In the mid-1980s, despite mild teasing about his sexuality, Moore gained a reputation through his involvement with drugs. His aggressive demeanor became apparent after a party incident where he awoke to find his wallet and $400 stolen. Fueled by rage and wielding a baseball bat, he accused a 17-year-old of the theft and severely assaulted him at his home, leading to severe injuries. Arrested for assault and weapon possession, Moore argued self-defense but ultimately pleaded guilty, receiving a $200 fine. He hated it when anyone stole from him. In 1986, Douglas Donald Moore faced conviction on 4 counts of sexual assault on children in Brampton, leading to a 2-year probation. However, his criminal history continued. In August 1988, Moore committed a heinous act, sexually assaulting a 12-year-old boy in Surrey, BC. The RCMP reported that Moore accosted the boy near a vacant house, forcibly leading him into a bathroom where he subjected him to a sexual act. November 1989 saw Moore sentenced to 4 years in prison for this assault. Moore's predatory behavior persisted. In December 1991, he arrived in Ontario and targeted a 14-year-old Mississauga boy. Despite being under mandatory supervision, Moore was wanted on a Canada-wide warrant for leaving British Columbia. His actions were reprehensible,
to say the least.
And in July 1992, he received another 4-year sentence for the sexual assault. Experts analyzed Moore's profile. At 24 years old, he was deemed likely to reoffend. Their assessment painted a grim picture. Offenders like Moore tended to be coercive and violent and had increased likelihood of abducting children.
Okay, so they keep letting him out. Okay, mm-hmm. So just let me ramble for a second.
Yeah.
Victims, there's a long-term effect on victims, right?
Right.
And we also see, like, this guy Moore, what his father did to him, that, you know, hurt people, right?
Yeah.
Often in the same way. This is proven.
And we're not blaming the victims here, because not every victim does that.
Not every victim, but there's patterns, right? And we know this.
Sorry, I shouldn't use the word victim survivor.
But for the good of society, like, why don't we put them away? The people that do this, put them away for much, much longer and ensure they're not going to reoffend if they're released, and keep close tabs. Because what's happening is we're ending up with people, some of the victims, survivors, learn that way and offend. Others can't deal with it, turn to drugs.
That's what I did.
End up on the street. So by trying to do this, like, balance, you know, well, you know, it's almost like, well, he only hurt a 14-year-old boy, like, for a weekend or for a year.
In this guy's case, it was many more.
So we can't put him away for a really long time, because it wasn't like murder. And even in murder, you get 15 years and you get laid out half the time. But he goes on to do this and he's creating more hurt. And, you know, I care about the individuals, you know, the survivors, but it also creates societal problems, right? And it's sort of a false economy. You know what I mean?
So in June of 1997, a rather unusual decision unfolded within the Canadian penal system. Having served a portion of his sentence, Moore's stay in jail was extended beyond the typical 2/3, a move that raised eyebrows among federal officials. There was talk about a dangerous offender designation for Douglas Moore. Of course there's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
In Canada, the dangerous offender designation is a legal status for individuals convicted of severe personal injury offenses, indicating a high likelihood of future violent or sexual crimes. The status can result in an indeterminate prison sentence, potentially keeping the individual incarcerated indefinitely. Key criteria for this designation, as outlined in the Criminal Code of Canada, include a conviction of a serious personal injury offense, a pattern of repetitive behavior indicating a risk of future harm or severe psychological damage to others, evidence of a threat to public safety, and evidence of persistent aggressive behavior. Boy, this sounds like Douglas Moore to me.
You think?
Doesn't it to you? The legal process to designate someone as a dangerous offender involves a conviction for a relevant offense, which he had, followed by a comprehensive legal review, including psychiatric evaluations to assess the risk they pose. If deemed a dangerous offender, the individual faces, as we mentioned, an indeterminate sentence and is detained until no longer considered a significant threat. I think that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
The stringent process ensures the designation is reserved for those posing a clear danger to public safety. So again, I ask, why didn't they look harder at this? I mean, our system balks.
They're chicken to use the term dangerous offender. It's too small L liberal. No, not big L, small L. It's just like, you know what? If we can't, what are the basics in society? You know, for me, people who have different physical and mental challenges and health should be looked after, right? Mm-hmm. And we should be protected from the bad people. And they're failing drastically on that front.
Yeah.
On both sides, frankly.
Totally. Several high-profile cases in Canada have underscored the gravity of crimes committed by individuals who either received the dangerous offender designation or whose actions sparked discussions about it. Notably, Paul Bernardo, involved in numerous sexual assaults and the murders of three teenagers in the early 1990s, did not receive this designation due to his life sentence, but is often mentioned in the context of such discussions due to the nature of his crimes. We are planning a multi-episode series on Bernardo's crimes for the summer of 2024. In episodes 57 and 58, we covered notorious serial killer Clifford Olson, who admitted to the murders of 11 young individuals in the early 1980s, and John Martin Crawford, convicted of murdering three Indigenous women, highlight scenarios where the designation reflects the court's view of the perpetrator's ongoing danger to society. We have yet to cover Crawford. Similarly, Terry Driver, the Abbotsford Killer, Dark Poutine Episodes 2 and 3, and Michael Wayne McRae, Episode 67, a serial murderer, were deemed dangerous offenders, emphasizing the Canadian legal system's commitment to public safety by restricting the freedoms of those seen as a significant and continuing threat. This designation, applied in extreme cases, illustrates a mechanism for protecting society from individuals with a proven history of severe and violent crimes. This wasn't meant to be in the case of Douglas Donald Moore, though. In 1997, the parole board ordered Moore's release to a halfway house on Robert Street in Hamilton. Here, he would tread the delicate line between freedom and supervision. The halfway house offered a semblance of autonomy, and Moore could move about unsupervised, a privilege granted despite his troubling past.
Let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. If you are really bad at your job, right?
Yeah.
So, and somebody dies because you're completely inept. So if you are like a really bad, you work for the railway and you're really bad at what you do and it causes a crash and people die, you can go to jail for that, right?
Sure. Negligent homicide. We talked about that in episodes 311 and 312.
Yeah. Why can't the parole board people be charged with negligent homicide?
That's a great question. That's a great question. That's an interesting take on it, too.
Yeah.
Because later on, people die.
Yep.
Partly due to people making decisions about Douglas Moore and his future.
Yep.
Considering what happened next, the decision sparked debate and speculation. What calculations weighed on the minds of those who held Moore's fate in their hands? As the halfway house door swung open, Moore, now unsupervised, stepped into a world where he could do as he pleased. After the halfway house, Moore secured employment at a manufacturing facility where he was involved in producing automotive parts from aluminum. This new phase also saw him moving into an apartment alongside his brother, who, as we mentioned, faced developmental challenges. During this period, Moore crossed paths with Sandra Martin, a young single mother and manager of a local KFC. Douglas quickly assumed a paternal role in the life of her 9-year-old son. Moore and his brother moved into Sandra's apartment. Leveraging his now relatively normal-looking life, he got up to his old tricks, befriending minors and establishing a new network of drug dealers operating from Meadowvale Town Center. However, Moore's freedom was short-lived when he found himself back in jail for a brief period due to possession of a concealed flick knife. Of course he had a weapon. I mean, you know. Upon his release, Moore and Sandra Martin decided to start anew by moving into a townhouse. Somehow, Moore wooed his way into babysitting three boys with developmental disabilities, ages 12 to 14, in a foster home. Even Peel's children's aide knew Doug Moore was hanging out at the foster home, but no one had reported anything unusual yet. A devious fox was in the henhouse, but no one knew it until it was too late. The local kids in Meadowvale whispered that Doug Moore was a pedophilic creep, but they had to get their dope somewhere. Doug Moore used his position as their dealer to lure them to where he wanted them.
So, at the introduction of this episode, when I started reading the script, not knowing what it was about, you pointed out that he dealt to young teens. And I thought, that's odd. Like, a dealer's a dealer. Like, you're going to sell to anyone. I'm like, why are you pointing out young teens? And as I worked through the script, I'm like, oh, he probably wasn't even doing it for the money. It was just to find victims.
That's right. It's like the idea that pedophiles will put themselves, like you said, move next to a school or something like that. Or, I want to be a Boy Scout leader. Let's be a Boy Scout leader, because it gives you a fertile hunting ground.
Not that Boy Scout leaders are better.
No, I've had great Boy Scout leaders, but
I was only in Beavers, and it was, and I, you know, it's like mini Boy Scouts.
I think, yeah.
Can like Beavers and Wolves? I think we talked about this.
Beavers and Cubs.
Cubs. Yeah. I loved it.
Yeah, me too. In the early hours of October 26, 2003, Douglas Moore was awakened in his Meadowvale townhouse by the sound of a sliding patio door. Initially, he went back to sleep. Later, he discovered a burglary. His marijuana stash, credit cards, and cash totaling $3,800, along with gold jewelry valued at over $5,000, were missing. Echoing an earlier episode from his youth where he had attacked a thief, Moore's immediate response was fueled by rage. He searched the neighborhood and filed a police report, but unsatisfied, he installed a security system. He became convinced that Robert Greville and Joe Mancisi were behind the theft. Moore told anyone who would listen that he would get payback. After their disappearance, cops heard the story too many times to ignore it further. They were looking hard at Douglas Donald Moore as responsible for the disappearances and possibly two murders. Moore, however, claimed he knew nothing about Greville and Mancisi's disappearances, but something seemed very wrong with him. A month following the disappearance of Robert and Joseph, Rene Charlebois, a Meadowvale 10th grader, vanished after leaving school at 3:30 p.m. on December 12, 2003. Despite being a promising student, Rene had recently fallen into drug use and bad company. That day, Rene's routine walk home ended in mystery, leading his mother to report him missing by 9 p.m. Subsequent sightings in Meadowvale and his known drug purchases from Moore led police to suspect foul play by Moore and another teen he ran with, possibly to silence Rene, who may have known what happened to Mancisi and Greville. The Greville family faced Robert's 23rd birthday without him. Christmas came and went. With no news on Rene, the Charlebois family publicly criticized police for allegedly treating Rene's case lightly, a charge, of course, the police denied. Despite suspicions about Moore's involvement in Rene's disappearance and interest in searching his home for evidence related to the Mancisi and Greville cases, police didn't have enough evidence to get a warrant. Doug Moore and Sandra were fighting, and they separated in February of 2004. In early March, Moore's already wobbly house of cards collapsed. Douglas Moore visited a friend, Donna McKinnon, who worked with Sandra at KFC. He was stoned and visibly agitated and accompanied by Sandra's withdrawn son. A foster parent from the home Douglas had been frequenting informed Moore that a former foster child at the house had accused him of molestation and the police were looking into it. The local OPP was called and discovered that Moore had sexually assaulted his accuser and two other boys at the house between 2000 and the present. The next day, the foster children were removed and police sought Moore's arrest on sexual assault charges. Moore, forewarned by Sandra Martin, eluded capture, fleeing before police officers arrived. Just a few days later, on March 15, 2004, Douglas Moore was arrested at a Burlington motel by a tactical team prepared for his potential suicidal and combative behavior, using stun guns in the process to subdue him. After Dougie Moore's arrest, an associate holding on to Mancheesi's car for Moore in Orangeville sought advice from Sandra Martin on handling it. Moore instructed Sandra from jail to have the car destroyed. He wanted his associate to burn it. Thankfully, following a tip, cops got to it before it could be dealt with. Facing 11 charges of sexually assaulting the three foster children, Moore's case was delayed. The evidence of his involvement in the Mancheesi and Greville disappearances mounted, and he remained in custody. The police were going to hang on to him as long as they could. On March 19th, the body of what appeared to be a teenage male or young man was discovered in a landfill near Orangeville. They used DNA obtained from the homes of the three missing young men to determine who this might be. 2 weeks later, they had an answer. The body belonged to 15-year-old Rene Charlebois. A thorough forensic search was conducted at Moore's previous townhome. On April 1st, Moore's mother observed injuries from his arrest during a visit to the Maplehurst Detention Center, where her son denied the accusations of sexual assault or anything else the cops were trying to pin on him. On the morning of April 2nd at 3:30 a.m., Douglas Moore's body was found hanging from a bedsheet through the bars of his cell door at the Maplehurst Detention Center in Milton. A guard had been by on rounds only 30 minutes before, and all was well. Moore's cellmate slept through the whole affair and was distraught at finding the body. He didn't want to be falsely charged with murder. Moore had left a note. Quote, "I've been planning to kill myself for some time. I no longer wish to deal with any of this mess any longer," he wrote. On the note's reverse, in all caps, was "final thought," and then "I'm sorry, I'm finally free," end quote.
All about him.
Yeah, what a shame.
It is such a shame that he got away with it. Because I think actually killing himself is getting away with it. In this case, he should have been in jail for the rest of his life.
He should have. Moore had been on suicide watch for the first week of his incarceration, but had been taken off suicide watch when he assured his jailers he was fine. A Toronto Star article, dated April 6, 2004, reported on Rene Charlebois' funeral at St. Paul the Apostle Anglican Church, where Pastor Clefren Thompson of Exodus Deliverance Temple commemorated him as a young man with a bright future tragically cut short. Thompson touched on the modern-day challenges youths face, such as sexualization, crime, and drugs, and used his sermon to urge respect toward parents and for parents to guide their children wisely, emphasizing the importance of making the right choices. After the service, Rene's father, Gilles, expressed regret about his failed attempt to have Rene move to Ottawa with him in December. The headless, handless body found in Montreal was identified as Robert Greville. Municipal workers discovered remains on April 27, 2004, in a park along the St. Lawrence Seaway in Quebec, again in an area known by Doug Moore. This body, similarly dismembered, without a head or hands, was identified as Joe Mancheesi Jr. A woman whose sons had been molested by Moore in 1985 said she always thought it was just a matter of time until the creep killed someone. Police and the families of the slain young men had a lot of questions that would never be properly answered, as the killer of their sons had escaped in a fashion. He was no longer around to answer their queries. The coroner's inquest, automatically held after any in-custody death, revealed that part of what motivated Moore to take his life was his fear of being designated a dangerous offender. So even he knew he was a dangerous offender. He likely would have never again seen any freedom. And I agree, that's probably true.
Well, we don't. Judging from our system, who knows?
There had been people helping Moore cover up his crimes. The attention turned to them. Moore's common-law wife, Sandra Martin, was convicted of an accessory after the fact to murder. She received a 6-month sentence, and at sentencing, she apologized for her role.
Why did she only get 6 months?
That's a great question.
I mean, yeah, thanks for your apology, but you're a horrible human being.
Yeah. A 14-year-old boy who assisted Moore in disposing of the dismembered bodies of Mancisi and Greville was also found guilty of being an accessory after the fact. He also received a 6-month sentence, and because of his age at the time, we are unable to identify him. During the teen's trial, chilling details emerged. Moore had lured Mancisi and Greville to the garage of his Mississauga townhouse. There, one of them was tied to a chair and strangled with a skate lace. The other suffered a fatal beating with a baseball bat. The teen testified that he was present when they dug separate holes near train tracks to bury the slain men's heads and hands. However, he never disclosed the exact location, claiming he couldn't recall it. Worst of all, the teen admitted it had been him who'd stolen Moore's money and weed. Greville and Mancisi were innocent of the theft they'd been murdered for.
Jesus, that's dark.
Right? It isn't clear how this youngster knew how these young men were killed, or whether or not it was him who told Moore that, you know, it wasn't me, or it was those guys had to have done. You know what I mean? Like,
I wonder where this person is now.
Well, I hope he doesn't live next door is all I can say.
Yeah, yeah, because all of that's extraordinarily dark, and I don't know.
Right.
Right.
I mean, there's extenuating circumstances. He was a young person. And he was being gaslit by a pedophile, so...
He was probably being used by him as
well. Yes, yeah. Probably.
Look how handsome Robert Greville was.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, you look at these kids and...
Yeah.
Like Renee and Joe and Robert, and they look like good guys.
They look like just regular folk, you know?
They could have, like, all these bright... Sorry, I'm looking at pictures of them. Bright future ahead of them.
Yeah.
You know, handsome lads. They probably would have, like, had a really good life and all this.
All three of them have sparkles in their eyes. Yeah. And when you look at that picture that I sent in the script about Douglas Moore... He looks like he's dead.
He's a horrible creature.
It's clear that there was a bit of a scuffle with the police, yeah. as mentioned in the script, because he's pretty bruised up. But, oh well, oopsie daisy. Not like he didn't deserve it. In the fall of 2005, Joe Mancisi Sr. used a psychic to aid in finding the missing parts of his son, but came up empty. Police believe the missing body parts are buried somewhere near Cornwall, but no one has found them yet. And that's it for Dark Poutine episode 313, Murders in Meadowvale, Robert Greville, Joseph Mancisi, and Renee Charlebois.
That's right. It's time for voicemails. You can leave us a message at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you. Let's see who called us this week.
Let's listen to our voicemails. Here's our first one.
Hi, Mike and Matthew. This is Sarah from Florida, who hadn't called since 2023. I'm gutted that my last message didn't go through. I can't remember what it was. I remember I had just come from my mammogram appointment and something you had said had inspired me to talk about the breast health, probably, or something like that. Funny enough, listening to the part one of your background on Rust, which is captivating. Oh, my goodness. I'm loving all of your background knowledge of this production stuff as well. I was going to call anyway because at the very beginning of today's episode, Matthew said something to the effect of, I'm here all tits and teats or something like that. And I don't know if I heard that correctly, but if I did, I need to know the origin of that expression because that, again, after having left you my last message after my mammogram, tits and teats, it's very much on my mind, I guess. At any rate, thank you, gentlemen, as always, for the incredible amount of time and research that you put into these shows. I was kind of shocked to see that you were doing this show about rust, but I'm fascinated. So brilliant work. So yes, please keep up the wonderful work. Take a duke in your toque, and I will anxiously await, hopefully hearing the origin story of whatever that expression was that Matthew said. Take care, and yes, hugs and kisses from the Sunshine State.
So Matthew, oh, that was a great voicemail, by the way. Matthew, tits and teeth. Explain.
Tits and teeth. I don't know where it comes from, but actually, I think Justin said it for the first time. It's when you want to sort of make an impression or get what you want, you sort of stick your chest out and smile. So it's like tits and teeth, girls.
Yep.
So I don't know where it came from. Probably somewhere in the UK. I'm gonna assume, but. Yeah.
Well, there is a podcast called the Tits and Teeth Podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But there's also in the Urban Dictionary, whenever I want to know, I'll go there. So it's an expression used between girls to explain how you get something you want by using a man's weak desires, especially when it comes to getting away with doing things you shouldn't.
Well, you know, we used to...
show a bit of tits and teeth.
A bunch of friends and I used to go to a gay bar. And just before we'd go in, somebody would always yell, tits and teeth, girls, as we walk in.
Yeah, there you go. Well, because you want to impress the other patrons.
Tits and teeth.
There you go. So that's what tits and teeth is. So funny. And it's too bad you couldn't talk to us about breast health. Matthew and I don't know a lot about that, but my mom used to call it, go get a mash. You had to go get mashed.
I think that somebody should open a dental office and mammogram place and call it tits and teeth.
Oh my God, that would be perfect.
Wouldn't that be great?
It would be funny. Oh, well, let's move on. We've got some more voicemails, and this one's a two-parter because for some reason the person got cut off, but we'll hear about that.
Hi, Mike and Matthew. It's Angela calling from the Yumber Yard. I have to call back. My son just came out to tell me something, so sorry, I'll call right back.
That's great.
So here's the second part.
Part two.
Hey, Mike and Matthew. This is Angela calling back. I'm from Keswick, Ontario. I called before. Sorry, my son had come out to ask me a question, and I was in the middle of trying to record this, but just want to say that I am incredibly jealous of you, Mike, considering you got to meet Jensen Ackles. When I heard that, my jaw dropped. I've been a Supernatural fan since the day it came out, and he's my favorite actor. So, yeah, when I heard that, my jaw dropped. And, Matthew, we all miss you in the Yumber Yard, dude. Come back. Sorry about my voice. I lost it on Good Friday, and unlike Jesus, after 3 days, it did not rise again. So... but anywho, guys, go take a shit in your hat and keep up the amazing podcast.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I've had a few people message me, where's Matthew? Is he okay? And I just say he's busy.
On March the 1st, mm-hmm. So it's been just over a month, not because of drama or anything. I'm just like, you know what? I think I just want to take a little social media break. I do post still... post on Steve Couldn't Leave, pictures of Steve on Instagram. And the thing is, the only thing I miss about social media is the Yumber Yard.
Well, there you go. So just come back to that only.
Yeah, yeah, I should. I know.
Love you, Matt.
I thought I'd take a couple weeks break, and then I just, you know.
Yeah. They're asking me, is he dead? Maybe using a bot.
Okay, so even my aunt texted me saying, somebody asked about something in the Yumber Yard, about something you said. Can you answer for me? And then I'll answer them for you and I'll sound really smart.
So I told her, and she texted. Oh my God. I also got a call. I got a text from somebody who used to be my boss, now is a friend and colleague. He's like, I was just at an event and somebody heard my name and said, are you the Olin that Matthew talks about on Dark Poutine? I'm like, I think I maybe mentioned you once.
I don't know if he mentioned his name. I didn't.
I must have because yeah, isn't that hilarious?
Oh, well. I'm sorry I didn't edit it out. Anyway, I didn't catch that.
Thank you. No, it's fine. He thought it was the coolest thing ever. He's like, I'm famous by proxy. Thank you, Angela, from the Yumberyard and your son. The way she said from the Yumberyard, I'm like, Angela and her son live in the Yumberyard.
Yep, that's where they're from. No, they're from Ontario.
And maybe I'll come back in Keswick, which used to be called Medina.
There you go. Funky Cold Medina.
Funky Cold Medina. I recently listened to that song, and it's not very PC anymore.
No, it's not. It's definitely not.
It's actually anti-trans.
Yeah, it's not good.
Well, not really, but there's like a suggestion of violence. So, yeah, I was like, oh, that's such a shame. It's a fun tune, right?
But yes, come back to the Yumberyard.
Okay.
People need you. People need your influence, Matthew. Okay, we have one more voicemail that we're going to play. One more. Just one more.
Hi, Mike and Matthew. I just was the person that left the last voicemail from the South Shore, Nova Scotia. Don't play that one. I haven't had enough coffee today. Anyways, I just wanted to call and say I listened to the latest episode on the murder of Mercy Babcock. Very well done. I'm a history nerd. I enjoy those episodes. You both made some really good points about how people twist religion for their own selfish gain, something that's supposed to be a good thing. Whether it's, you know, for themselves or politics or to have influence over things, other people, it's wrong. And it makes me think about how cults are formed and how they're very successful, very similar. Even back then, religion was such a huge part of people's lives. And, so for him to do that, he really went after people. And I don't know, it's spiritual abuse. I'm a Christian myself, and it makes me angry to hear stories like that. But even like today, when people do this stuff, and it happens more often than it should. Anyways, good episode, and go take a poop in your tube.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for that.
That's it for this week's voicemails. Again, you can leave us one at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you, even if it is just to say hi and to tell us to go shit in our hats. If you're stumped for what to chat with us about, a quick story is welcome. So let's move on to donut money donors and Patreon. So first up, we have a patron, and this person's name is Tom, just Tom.
Tom.
and I don't know where Tom is from.
Tom is from Liechtenstein.
Liechtenstein. Okay. Yes. Does he live in, is there a castle or is that New Schwanstein? I think I've got it wrong.
I don't know, but he's from Oberdorf.
Okay. What does he do there in Oberdorf?
He makes milk chocolate.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Mm-hmm. I like milk chocolate. I had a little bit of it for Easter. It was good.
Yeah. I had no chocolate at Easter.
Oh, boy. Next up, we have Deborah Netzker. And I don't know where Deborah's from either, Matthew.
Deborah Netzker is from the city of Turin in Italy.
Turin, Italy? Oh, yes. Interesting. And what does she do there in Turin? Does she deal with a certain shroud?
Oh, yeah. That was from Turin, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
No, she does not.
Okay.
She is a journalist,
mm-hmm.
and she's actually done some. There was a lot of issues with sex workers being in danger in Turin, and she's done some good stories and exposés about that.
There you go.
I don't know why I went all serious with that.
You did. It was very weird.
We usually do fun ones, but I'm just like, a friend of mine did a song about, wrote a song about Turin, and it's kind of about that, and it just jumped into my head. So there you go.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Sorry. Very much. Sorry for giving you such a serious one, but keep up the good work.
And she wears a funny hat. Well, she's doing it.
Yeah. There you go.
Exactly.
She's going to like, I want my money back. Tell me a better one.
And we don't have any donut money donors this week, but that's okay. We know we will. Thanks to all our patrons and donut money donors, past and present, for your generosity. It helps to keep the show going. You can become a patron of Dark Poutine at patreon.com/darkpoutine. For a one-time donation, you can send us donut money via PayPal using our email address, darkpoutinepodcast@gmail.com. If you don't already subscribe to the show, it would mean a lot if you did. You can easily find Dark Poutine on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. If you haven't gotten yours yet, my book, Murder, Madness, and Mayhem, is available to order via a link on the Dark Poutine website. And speaking of darkpoutine.com, please check it out for show notes and other cool stuff. We'd appreciate it if you took the time to give Dark Poutine a like or a follow on Facebook and Instagram. Most importantly, thank you for listening, and tell your friends about us. Word of mouth is a powerful thing. And that's it for this episode of Dark Poutine. So until next time, don't forget to be a good egg and not a bad apple.
Don't be a bad yablica.
Nah.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.